Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Cesano.
Hello, everyone, and welcome into the Ether. Today, I have Amin Soleimani, founder and CEO of SpankChain, on the podcast. Amin is also one of the original people on the team who built Moloch DAO and is a prominent Ethereum community member. Thanks for joining me today, Amin.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Definitely. I'm excited for the conversation. I'm sure many listening have heard of you in the past, but can you kind of just give a quick background of yourself and how you ended up getting involved with crypto?
Sure. My story starts buying Bitcoin in college to use to purchase mushrooms. I later learned how to code and then built Bitcoin arbitrage bots and lost all my money in Mt. Gox. Took about 2 years off crypto and then got back into it when Ethereum was launching, learning how to program smart contracts on it in about 2016, and then joined ConsenSys from there. At ConsenSys, I mostly focused on micropayments. I worked on energy trading. I helped launch AdChain, an ad fraud detection platform, in the first TCR. Then I left to start SpankChain, which we built some of the first micropayment systems using payment channels on Ethereum, and a bunch of other stuff, and have since then also launched Moloch, the DAO to help coordinate Ethereum public goods funding.
Nice. Yeah, we're going to dive deep into both of those, kind of mushrooms and getting hacked at Mt. Gox, kind of a Bitcoin story as old as time, I guess. Yep. Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I think that's a good background. And you mentioned SpankChain, and I obviously want to go there first. So I guess first I would just ask, well, for people maybe not aware, could you maybe describe it? And then, you know, how did the idea come about? Was it something that you've thought about in the past before learning about Ethereum, or is it just something that clicked for you?
Yeah, so I was actually interested in micropayments technology before I knew about Ethereum. And part of learning about Ethereum was realizing that this was possible with today's technology and just needed to be implemented. Originally, when I was trying to think of use cases for micropayments, when I was at ConsenSys, I was interested in things like education, real-time tip pay per minute for tutoring, for example. But I realized that a lot of things start in the adult industry. And so, maybe porn was a good first use case. And in trying to do that, I was basically, how did the name come about? It was like, sitting in a car stone with a bunch of my friends and somebody just said SpankChain. And that was it. We all geeked out laughing and sort of figured that if we found this as hilarious as we did, the rest of the world probably would too, and thought it was a fitting name, float off the tongue. The idea came about, as I was sort of looking for the exits when I was at ConsenSys and trying to figure out what I wanted to build next. And so I wanted to put the micropayments technology to use. So that's how it started. And then it sort of evolved into us realizing that, like, actually for the adult industry, like, banking is a big problem and they could benefit a large amount from, cryptocurrencies that are uncensorable in order to store their money and transact without fear of, seizure or censorship. So that's what has driven us. And now we are building infrastructure to onboard the adult industry to our platform and to cryptocurrency. And so we built Spank.live, which is our CAM site that is powered by the payment channels technology that we developed with Kinext. And that's been in production since April of last year. And so initially we had unidirectional Ether only payment channels, and then we upgraded and we built non-custodial payment channels where the performers are actually receiving money in real time into a wallet that they control and that we can't take money out of. And that is very powerful. And the EF was kind enough to give us a $420,000 grant between us and Kinext for shipping that. We're now also moving to building Spank Pay, which is sort of like you know, a crypto payment processor does the same sort of thing as BitPay, but it's branded and focused on the adult industry. So it's pretty in pink, and it's a strong payments brand in a sort of wash of, you know, not very interesting payment systems that the adult industry has had for the last 20 years. And so we're hoping to get merchants to engage. And we have our first partnership secured there. It's live on a site, which I won't say right now because we're about to launch a marketing video around it. But yeah, looking to grow both the sort of business to business parts as well as the more consumer side. And so we're also building a clip site to allow performers to sell their clips directly to fans and monetize their content that way.
Yeah, you guys have always been on the cutting edge of kind of the payment channel and layer two solutions. I remember seeing it, gosh, man, what has it been, like a year and a half, 2 years? Time flies in crypto, I guess. But I always joke, like 1 month in crypto is basically a year in real time. But I guess, can you talk a little bit about your state channel solution? You mentioned Connects. We've had Connects on the podcast. Kind of what teams are you working with? Is this your own solution, or, you know, are you kind of merging ideas with other teams? Just kind of how does it work on Spank Chain?
Yeah. So initially we used Machinimi, and that was our very simple Ether only payment channel. And that was, Sergey lives in Russia. He built the Machinimi library, and then we, with the help of Kyokan, put it into production and, you know, help make the library more robust, test it, figure out all the edge cases, and deploy it to real world use. Several months after that, we teamed up with Connects to iterate. It iterated quite far because the sort of technology tree goes from like unidirectional, you know, Ether only to like bidirectional Ether only to like, you know, then add ERC-20 tokens and like then maybe add non-custodial payments as part of that as well. So instead, we basically jumped all the way to the end and we tried to do all of those things at the same time. And that didn't quite work because we got hacked and lost $40,000, and it was a smart contract bug. And so we had to like take a step back, review all our code. You know, we were having like full dev team meetings going line by line on the contract to figure out like what vulnerabilities the hacker exploited and also like what other vulnerabilities there might be. And we decided to like scrap the entire piece of code and create, you know, the same system from scratch again. And we did that. Took another couple months, but at the end of it, you know, it had all the features that we were talking about, the ability to do bidirectional channels, the ability to have Ether and a token inside the same channel, and the ability to do atomic swaps within those channels, and also the ability to not only use a hub as an intermediary, but use a hub in order to set up what's called a virtual channel or sub-channel directly with so the user is connected to the hub, the performer is connected to the hub. The user can create this sub channel that is sort of enforced in the same way that a normal payment channel is enforced by a smart contract on Ethereum by the higher level payment channel. So you have the payment channel between the user and the hub, which is used to enforce the payment channel between the user and the performer directly. And so the user can pay performer directly in such a way that the performer can later go to the hub and say, hey, the user paid me this much, please send me the money. And the hub knows that they can get the money from the user. And so it's a sort of, you know, virtuous system where everybody knows that as soon as they sign the message that like, and they receive the signed message that the payment is finalized and that they can claim that payment. It's a fairly complex system. And we ultimately, I think it'll be important for some fraction of the global economy where there isn't enough trust in the hubs, that where you trust the hub to maybe, you know, set up your connection, but you don't want the hub to, you don't necessarily trust them to like pay you out. You don't want them to owe you any money. And so for that, you'll want to do this type of non-custodial payment system. But we realized that it was a little bit overkill for our use case and that performers and many of the businesses that we are talking to don't actually care so much about you know, having it be completely non-custodial. They're okay with a small amount of funds being held in custody so long as they know that they can withdraw at any time and receive it. And so this is sort of the ultimate, you know, the value of layer two systems is like where you don't have that trust, and being able to have scalable payments in the absence of that is where they're most valuable.
Yeah, definitely. Helps on cost, user experience, and keeps the trustlessness, right? I mean, it's interesting. I've kind of run into that too. Like, some people don't care about complete non-custodial, right? Like, there's definitely a little bit of a trade-off there. If you could gain a little bit better features, but there's just a small bit of trust there. It'll be interesting to see where this all goes. And I guess I'll use this as an opportunity to just kind of get your thoughts on layer two solutions and progress in general right now on Ethereum. It's interesting. I was at ETH New York, and like the day before, there was a layer two panel, and there's just so many solutions popping up. So I'm curious to see what you think of many of them. Do you kind of see one solution or team kind of quote unquote winning in the end, or do you think we're going to have, you know, 8 or 10 different options out there?
I have seen and have always seen layer two as a framework. So it's just a programming framework, just like there's so many JavaScript frameworks for building apps, right? There's React, but there's also, like there was jQuery back in the day, and then there's Handlebar, you know, and Backbone, and like Angular and Ember. And so, you know, these things are basically like JavaScript libraries to help you make websites, right? Layer two is kind of the same. They have different trade-offs. They have different purposes. I don't see one really maybe, you know, winning in the sense that, like, I don't really see layer two as capturing a lot of value on the basis of the technology alone. I see layer two as capturing value on the basis of the relationships that the business that operates the layer two hub or chain is able to get. For something like Connext, right, they're operating a payment channel hub. Well, it's, you know, really easy for other teams that want to have, you know, micropayments available on their sites to integrate Connext and manage their, you know, user payments and potentially even payouts through the Connext hub. And if they did that, then they pay, you know, a tiny fee, they get the security, they have, you know, no chargebacks, better user experience. But ultimately, it's like a business for Connects to go out and get these clients and get them to integrate their hub, because anybody else could also spin up a hub. And the point of Connects is sort of to keep this open source ethos and to allow a network to form. Connects is betting on the network as being, you know, sort of helpful to everybody that is operating hub, because then the hubs can network and transfer value and make going through a hub more valuable to everyone that wants to. Now, Plasma is a sort of different beast. You have some trade-offs between Plasma and payment channels. One of the challenges of Plasma is, you know, you have these like longer withdrawal windows. And the reason, whereas in payment channels, it can be a lot faster, because as long as me and the hub agree that I can withdraw my money, then, and you know, I have a specific amount of money, then like I can withdraw immediately. On the other hand, if it's Plasma, the money could be mine. It could be anybody else's who has pooled their money in that Plasma chain. And so we have to give everybody the opportunity to express a challenge if the money is theirs that I'm trying to withdraw. And so that means that, like, fundamentally you have these like longer withdrawal windows. There's some research going on to make it faster, but that's what I didn't want for my performers. That's why I didn't want to use Plasma right off the bat. Plasma can also be more easily extended to having multiple parties act as validators than a payment channel hub can. So you can see it as potentially incentive aligning a larger group of people to coordinate around growing the network. If it's, you know, for example, a proof of stake chain or like some sort of round robin system, either way, you've sort of distributed the earnings of operating that layer two hub using Hub in like the logical way, not like a single server, that layer two, Plasma Chain to all of the participants. The thing that's most exciting about Plasma Chains is, to me, is like the ability to run smart contracts on them, which is certainly a challenging problem. I know that like Plasma Leap is on it. I know that Scale is on it. I'm not exactly sure which will win or create utility first. And I'm sure that there's a bunch of other like complexity and trade-offs that need to be put in place in order to like make sure that the contract execution is synchronized with what it would be on Ethereum if it was to then happen on Ethereum and be resolved on Ethereum. So the reason that I think that is interesting is because, for example, if we wanted to have Moloch run on its own chain, and have this like separate smart contract platform and have it manage its own security, like we could do that. We could even do it so that it's more scalable. It has some validators that process the transactions. What the validators are then giving us is like censorship resistance, right? Where the point of having multiple validators for a Plasma chain that has smart contracts is so that if one of the validators doesn't like you, the other ones will still send your transaction to the other Plasma chain operators and like mine your transaction. So you can get like much faster transactions that are still ultimately secured by Ethereum. And the other wild sort of wild card here is Polkadot, where not Polkadot directly, but Substrate, the platform that they're using, in order to create these parachains. Well, these are parachains that could ultimately be plugged directly into Ethereum if the infrastructure was there. Polkadot itself is a sort of glorified layer two, where it sits on top of and allows the chains below it to interoperate. It sits on top of all these layer one chains. And so it itself is this layer two. And then like, if you have another chain that you plug into it, a parachain, it sort of becomes this layer three that goes through this, Polkadot layer two to attach to one of those layer ones. And you can, and my point here is just like, you could potentially use Substrate, create a Plasma chain, plug it into Ethereum directly. And like, that's another candidate for layer two. So I see the code for deploying layer twos becoming commoditized rather quickly. And then I see the market opportunity being awarded most to the players that are savvy and most able to leverage their existing relationships or make new relationships around bringing people onto these layer two platforms.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how the incentive game plays out on layer two as well. Like, I would like to run a Connects hub right now. There will be eventually soon, I think, but a way to incentivize that hub. I mean, I personally would run one just on my Avato box using Dapnode, because if I could just one click install it, whatever, right? I already have the hardware running. But these layer two solutions are definitely going to have to find out the proper way to incentivize people to decentralize the solution. So I'm really interested to see how that's going to play out over the next year or two as well. You talked about Moloch, so I think it's a good time to transition to that. I guess for those who aren't aware, which if you're listening to this, it's probably a bit hard for you not to be aware, but Moloch DAO is a grants DAO that enables pretty much anybody that wants to join to find a current member, say, hey, I want to join. You have to give some Ether and you're given shares and voting rights to the DAO. And then eventually those funds are used to fund projects and ideas that better the Ethereum ecosystem. So I know you were involved in the original idea. You've kind of become, in my opinion, the face of the Moloch DAO. So how did the original idea come about? And, what's with the name and how did that come about as well?
Yeah, so I originally discovered Moloch around the same time I discovered Ethereum. I was living on the balcony of a rationalist house in Berkeley with a bunch of people that are really into like cognitive biases and a blog called Less Wrong and trying to like, use logic to be better calibrated with reality. And one of the blogs they like is called Slate Star Codex. And he has this post called Meditations on Moloch, which basically lays out all the ways that humans can't have nice things and points out how it's not actually, there is no demon god Moloch. It's like all in our heads. It's actually just us. So the reason that humans can't have nice things is because we can't coordinate well enough together in order to do that. And so like we would prefer to spend our money as a society on like, you know, healthcare, education, infrastructure, but we end up spending it on guns and bombs and planes, because if I was the only nation that was spending money on guns and bombs, I would be able to take everyone else over. And so you end up in this like really unfortunate equilibrium where everybody has to invest in military spending just in order to defend against the chance that one nation will, you know, overpower them. And because everybody else is. So like once you see Moloch, you can't stop seeing it. And learning about it right around the same time as Ethereum made it obvious to me how much Ethereum could advance our ability to solve coordination problems. Because what Ethereum fundamentally is, it's a platform for you. I mean, you could say it's fancy escrow and you'd be like 80% right. But what it allows you to do is create these credible commitments to future cooperations, right? If I stake some tokens, you and I both know that like I can't walk away from that stake easily. I have made some commitment to having some position in the future. And that makes it easier for you to potentially coordinate with me. And so because you can do this and because we can encode logic into these things in ways that might have otherwise using the legal system and, you know, the justice system as like our execution engine been much more costly, we can do it far cheaper. So and it, like the way Moloch works is that it allows a bunch of people to pool money and then vote on how that money is spent. And also it retains minority protections in that anybody can leave if they disagree with the direction that the DAO spending is going. And we haven't actually signed any paperwork, any legal contracts. I wrote a smart contract with some assistance. It was about 400 lines. You know, had a lot of community support around it, but like that was it, right? We deployed the contract, threw up a UI, and everybody who joined is basically just following the smart contract rules. Now, doing something like this within the context of the legal system would have been up to, you know, 100 or 1,000 times more expensive, right? This is something that like one, you know, a few people could sort of write and then a bunch of people could rally around and use. And not only that, like it's open source, like other people are already forking it, copying it and using it themselves, which means that the cost, like, you know, for us, the people who developed it, the cost was, you know, so much, but the cost for the next person to use it is next to nothing. And that just means that, you know, to me that we're going to be able to coordinate around, coordinate at much lower cost, and being able to coordinate at lower cost to me means that the most exciting opportunities are the ones where we're going to witness unprecedented levels of coordination, because it's coordination that was otherwise too expensive to be feasible, but now is cheaper and feasible. And so the people who are going to, I think, do really well are the ones who recognize opportunities around unprecedented levels of coordination.
Yeah, I mean, the barrier to entry and the cost is so low. I mean, I've personally nominated three people who have gotten in. And I mean, it's literally a Telegram message, a quick questionnaire, and you're like, you can be up for nomination within probably 10 minutes, right? And it costs you, what, less than 1 cent to put the transaction through. So it's pretty amazing how we can coordinate these funds. And I think it's slowly approaching 2 million under management. And it's become a bit of a meme legend, I guess, in crypto. Has it taken off faster than you expected it would?
I didn't expect it to work, really.
So yes.
Yeah. I was mostly focused on just it not breaking. I spent the last several days of writing tests just, you know, being like, please don't be Stefan Twal. Like, please don't break. Please don't lose a bunch of other people's money. But I was sort of happy with how we scaled it up. It started out with, you know, grassroots community effort of 22 founders who each put 100 ETH of their own money, from, you know, all across like executives in the industry to investors to developers to enthusiasts. Everybody sort of came together to do this. And then from there, the momentum that that brought in and the validation that we were able to get around delivering value to the Ethereum ecosystem by using these funds and being able to not only use these funds, but do it far more efficiently in terms of, you know, there's no accounting division. There's no paperwork for issuing grants. Like, there's a 1 week turnaround on the votes. And so, like, if you're trying to get a grant, like, it's really fast to have an answer at least. And that proved that the model worked. And that's what stimulated, you know, Vitalik and Joe Lubin and Consensus and the EF each coming in for 1,000 Ether and putting the total up to $1.5 million and inspiring others to contribute. And so now it's growing to up to 2 million and, you know, could even grow faster or, you know, get larger from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we had a kind of a Moloch meetup in New York, which a good amount of members came out. I guess it's been, what, three weeks now or so. Can you just kind of give a high level recap of what was talked about there and mainly around how we can socially scale this? Because obviously we're already up to, I think there's something like 50 members now. So, you know, slowly operational overhead costs is going up. Of course, you have the rage quit mechanism where you can get out if you disagree, which appeases that a lot. But then on the other side, besides this social scalability, kind of where, you know, obviously you're just one person in the DAO, so not one person can influence, but where you think kind of the best investments Moloch can make over the next, say, 6 months would be?
Sure. So let's start with the meetup. The meetup, like, the code is actually not the whole hard part, right? Like, the code takes advantage of the fact that there is an existing community of people who want to see Ethereum succeed. And this is just so happens to be the right tool for them to pool their money and spend it together, right? There's a whole other category of social coordination that needs to take place. And that's like deciding, you know, what do we, you know, are we on Discord? Do we have a forum? Who manages this stuff? Like, what's the right procedure for accepting a grant? Like, what happens if one person says no to somebody who wants to get a grant? Are they allowed to go to other people? Like, how do we communicate that so that we're more resistant to spam? All those kinds of things are important sort of decisions that get made and can be updated because they're only socially enforced, right? There's no like hard rules in this except for what's encoded in the contract. And what's encoded in the contract is basically minimal. It only really pertains to how the money gets spent and how it can be withdrawn. So that's like what we were deciding. We were deciding, you know, when to have our first meetup or like meeting where we can, you know, have an agenda and go through some of these assigned tasks and divide up responsibilities and go from there. As for spending. We started out wanting to primarily fund ETH2 things. I think that that's a good start. We have Kyokan on retainer. We're paying them $6,000 a month to just sort of do, like ETH2, I would say project management somewhat and more like tech coordination, trying to look ahead and see if there's anything that we anticipate that might be an issue that we could write a report about. We're like, so far they've taken ownership. Matt Slipper, CTO of Kyokan, taken ownership of a lot of the networking that is going on. He wrote the networking spec. We brought on Antoine, who's been doing a test runner for how the nodes will talk to each other, that each of the nodes will be able to use. So building tools like that will benefit all of the teams that no individual team would build themselves. Stuff like that is super important. And I want to see more of that. And so like another thing that Moloch is funding is like a libP2P report, which would be trying to understand like to what degree will libP2P out of the box satisfy the needs for ETH 2.0 and to what degree do we need to put some work in order to make it work? Or are there other alternatives that we should be using? And this is like a pretty critical piece of the infrastructure for ETH2 that, you know, it has so thus far been sort of assumed to be the thing to use. And like the thing about libT2P is that no actual production blockchains, to my knowledge, use it, but a bunch of hypothetical blockchains use it or plan to use it. And so there hasn't really been battle tested yet. So we're trying to make sure that that goes through. Other things are, I could see Moloch doing well funding some layer two projects, some Plasma, trying to mostly focus on areas that the EEF is already not funding, so that we're not really doing diminishing returns or stepping on any toes. Things that could be more rapidly addressed. So like another thing is like Vitalik wrote a spec for a mixer, and we haven't found anybody to do it yet, but there's a sort of open call for somebody to come along and build this mixer that Vitalik specified, and we would fund you for Moloch to do it, because this would be a critical piece of infrastructure for the Ethereum ecosystem. And because, you know, we all want it. Another thing we could do is like, fork Substrate and make it plug directly into Ethereum. And that would, you know, expand the value of Polkadot's contribution to open source greatly by, you know, increasing the reach of their Substrate library. And in order to do that, we'll need to like update eWASM on Ethereum. And so I'm open to funding reports on the state of eWASM in Ethereum. Also, other privacy solutions. I would love to see like GUIs for scheduling transactions. That's been a recent pain point after I've been submitting all these transactions to Moloch. Those are like the sort of category of things. And part of the idea is that like I didn't actually have a plan. A lot of people ask me, they're like, "What's your plan for Moloch?" And I was like, "Well, I didn't actually think I'd get this far. So I didn't actually think it made sense to plan this far ahead." So my plan was essentially to get to this point. And knowing that at this point, there are, you know, 50 other people who are in this DAO with me who are also smart, motivated, and want Ethereum to succeed, that all have good ideas. And for us all to be able to share and come up with other funding targets for grants together. And so like one of the interesting ways that Moloch is being used right now is like potentially fund some legal work to be done that would benefit, you know, everybody in Ethereum by adding additional protections for those who either purchased or sold or traded tokens that were issued in ICOs. Right. So there's a lot of things that might fit the mold. And ultimately it depends on whatever the Moloch members vote on. And if any members disagree and the vote passes, well, that member will always have the option of not putting their money towards that grant and rage quitting and taking their money out.
Yeah, the rage quit mechanism is game theoretically genius, in my opinion. I mean, it just makes you feel much more comfortable to be in it, because you know if it takes a direction you don't like, you can just get out. So I definitely agree with pretty much everything you listed. And for me, it's more kind of how Moloch at this point, you know, we're not going to give out a $400,000 grant to Prylabs, right? It's just that's not what we're
there for now. Yeah, that's not what it's for.
Right. It's more these low hanging fruit items, kind of like the mixer, right? Like it wouldn't cost that much, but like the entire Ethereum ecosystem could benefit from privacy through a mixer, right? So those kind of items are personally what I'm trying to look out for. And it's interesting, we actually just had a proposal go through that was actually voted down. It was one of the first like large funding. I think it was for a Block Explorer. So members are definitely active in what they think should and shouldn't be funded. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes. On that topic, I think, you know, I want to shift into some more general Ethereum things. And I think first we should just segue from Moloch into general Ethereum funding. So there was obviously a lot of heated debate over the last few months about funding on Ethereum. There was a proposal to take some portion of block rewards and redirect it to some contract, which would eventually be managed by a DAO or some set of stakeholders. And that just caused a lot of tension in the community. Now that things have calmed down a little bit, and I'm sure this is going to come up because I don't think the teams making those proposals are done with them. Just kind of in general, where do you stand with Ethereum's funding issue or perhaps lack of funding? And do you think it's going to kind of be, are you okay with DAOs kind of like Moloch taking over the funding, or do you think we need to figure out something, or is it block rewards, or just kind of where do you stand on the issue?
Yeah, so let's tease this apart a little bit. There's a couple different things going on. So there was the 1789 EIP that was authored by Kevin Iwaki of Gitcoin, and that had the sort of rallying cry of like long-term sustainability for Ethereum. And in order to have long-term sustainability, well, we need money to pay for development. Where does that money come from? Well, the best place for it to come from would be inflation or from block rewards. The inflation word is triggering because people mostly take it to mean adding more bonuses for developers, but you could take some of the rewards from the miners and reroute them to developers. And then it was, you know, postulated that maybe we should use a DAO for this, some sort of decentralized structure, and maybe we should start researching how that should work, right? Then there's another camp, and that was primarily driven by Lane Reddig, and that was like, let's try to get money now. And let's, you know, funding is an immediate concern. We want to potentially even hard fork Ethereum in order to grant money from the block rewards or inflate some and then give it to a DAO that's run by the core devs, right? Not the EF. And there's within that camp, there's sort of strong opposition about the money being going to the EF because these are some of the core devs that are the most disillusioned with the EF. I mean, Lane was just fired. So like, you know, there's not a lot of camaraderie with the EF. They see the EF even as it's like getting better and trying to help stimulate the space as being the sort of overlord, which I don't really think makes a lot of sense. So then there's my perspective, which is that like both of these are valuable. I support long-term sustainability for Ethereum. I think it's very risky to bet everything on an untested system. So the way I would go about, you know, planning to have block rewards go to developers in 5 years is spend the next 5 years running like DAO experiments similar to Moloch, but do them on a volunteer basis. Don't hard fork over this. Don't, you know, start messing with the block rewards until one, like the community understands DAOs, knows how to DAO, is confident in our ability to allocate funding using DAOs and not make mistakes with, you know, everybody's money. The other thing was like, I was also interested in helping Ethereum get more money immediately. When Ether was at $100, it seemed like the Ethereum Foundation had, I don't know, 60 some million dollars, 70, I don't know, like around there at the time. And that was worrying simply because that meant that they had, I don't know, maybe like a 3 to 4 or 5 year runway if they're sort of stringent. And that meant that they might need to stop spending. And like, I'm of the opinion that, you know, the money spent today is much more valuable than money spent tomorrow. And so I didn't want them to slow down or stop. And so what I thought was the best move there was to just route some of the miners' block rewards from, you know, directly to the Ethereum Foundation or a multisig that they control. And really that was like, because, you know, I thought that the EF was the only institution in crypto at all, but like, you know, in Ethereum, that would be trusted enough to manage the money, such that a hard fork might succeed. Now, in order to get miner support, maybe there needed to be some politics to like get ProgPow at the same time or do some sort of horse trade for that. But like, that's what we were thinking. And as ETH went from 100 to 250, where it is right now, like my motivation for that roughly dropped by about 2.5 times, you know, because like, it just seems like less pressing of an issue. We all have a little bit more money. Like it seems that we're out of the worst of it. And that, you know, this is at least sustainable until we can drive further growth, and have, you know, the rest of our money potentially accumulate value as a result of that growth. So, right now I'm of the position that like, forget short-term hard forking the chain. Also like, you know, that has its own risk because you might end up with two chains and like the community might be less aligned and the value of both might be less than what they started. And that would just mean that everybody has less money. Right. So like, you shouldn't take that risk lightly when you're talking about, you know, these kinds of hard forks. So, my position right now is just like, Ethereum is fine. Funding is largely fine. What we need to be focused on is the efficiency of our funding, trying to do better allocation, but also like trying to like funding is one step of a process, and the process is like this feedback loop between identifying a need that will benefit the ecosystem, finding the person who will execute on that need, whether it's ship code or write some developer guides or whatever, and then secure funding for that person. Right. And this feedback loop within the EF, within Consensus, the two organizations that mainly do this, is on the order of months. It's very slow. And so the other thing that's interesting about Moloch is that we can speed that up. We can speed that up just, partly by having the gap between like funding secured and person found and funding secured be like a week, because that's how long it takes for a proposal to get voted on. But if the members are also diligent, then we can be broadcasting these, RFPs where we've identified a need and now can, scream it at the top of our lungs to everybody in the space and like try to really hone in on finding somebody to do it really fast and then submitting a proposal for them. So like between the time that Matt Slipper decided we need an ETH2 test runner, like he wrote that in his report, published it. The next day we started tweeting about it. The next day we found Antoine, we interviewed him. Next day we decided he was good enough, he could ship it. We submitted his proposal. 7 days later he had the money. So the whole thing took 10 days, right? That was like, I think, the fastest grants turnaround I've ever heard of. We haven't had as much luck with, for example, the Mixer, because we haven't found anybody to do it, but we have identified this need, right? And so like if somebody were to come forward, it would be very fast to secure funding for them if we thought that they could ship it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I fully agree with you on the block rewards. I mean, I'm pretty much exactly in the same camp as you. I mean, my biggest fear was going to be how easy it would be to capture. So I agree. We need something proven, some kind of system proven. Maybe that's Moloch someday, that isn't easily capturable and can make these decisions. Like my problem was, we're lying to ourselves if we don't think the core devs have the most influence in Ethereum's governance process, and they're going to be the ones benefiting from getting these block rewards. So why would they ever turn the faucet off, right? That's my biggest concern.
Yeah, they'll come up with 100 reasons why they're invaluable. Yeah, like part of, Lane thing, it was driven by the core dev that's the least core and the least dev. It made it a lot harder to rally around.
Yeah, definitely. It didn't seem to have too much universal support, and that was just seemed too willy-nilly. I think maybe we'll get there. And I guess in the past, Moloch wouldn't, in its current state, it wouldn't be able to take on additional funds just sent to it because people would be able to rage quit with a gain. But you're working on something to kind of appease that situation. Is that right?
Well, I'm working on a pool contract that allows you to participate in Moloch without having to be voted in, and you basically just park your money in it, and it does follow on grants at the same proportion that Moloch is distributing money. And you can also withdraw your money at any time from that. It's still capturable though, right? Like if you're the last person standing in Moloch, you give yourself a bunch of money and somebody's forgotten to take their money out of the pool, then you'll be able to get a bunch of money out of the pool. So my proposal was like, give the EF the money, have it go to one of their multi-sigs, and then have them participate in Moloch in such a way that like, they are bringing the money into the rest of the ecosystem, but it's not capturable by the rest of the ecosystem, where like they can still rage quit it if they need to out of the DAO. And like it comes back to sort of like Sybil resistance and 51% attacks, because like, in theory, like the money, if going straight to the EF, is like also, potentially capturable, but it's like only capturable if their multi-sig is captured, right? And ideally they have, identified parties as every multi-sig keyholder, and so they're not going to get captured like that. As for, DAOs that could just receive block rewards, like, ultimately capture is the problem, right? There's no, essentially no situation where you have money flowing into a DAO where like that thing is not capturable in some way, right? Like the reason Moloch's not capturable is because everybody can take their ball and go home at any time. But if there's this like external value that's being sent to the contract, then you know, you can't just take your ball and go home because you can't take your share of that block reward funding. You can't take the faucet with you. So it's a much harder problem. And like, I would like to see other experiments try to address that. And try to address it and then only use volunteer money, like donors' money to do it, so that they're not risking like the ecosystem's money or like hard forking over it before we know that it's even worth doing, right? If this was the beginning of Ethereum, like in the same way that Zcash set out to do this from the beginning, they said, okay, 20% of the block rewards are going to the Zcash Foundation or the Zcash Corporation. I don't remember which, but basically they have 20% of the block rewards. Like, that's easy to do at the inception of a project. It's a lot harder to do once a project has tens of billions of dollars in market cap and a global distributed community of stakeholders that, you know, all need to upgrade together if there's any upgrade to make.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the best cure at the end of the day for Ethereum funding is just price going up, right? So we all do whatever we can to make price go up. If that's investing, you know, either developing or building whatever you can, or investing funds you might have to better projects. I mean, that's my opinion, right? I know we all kind of panicked when it was down at $80 or whatever it hit, but at the end of the day, we need Ether to be valuable in general for this all to be successful. So if it's not, we're probably screwed no matter what.
Yeah. And Moloch is like in another light, like a satanic, you know, pump group for Ethereum.
Yeah, so exactly.
Join our satanic pump group.
Yeah. It's kind of become Ethereum's marketing machine a little bit, in my opinion, which is kind of been interesting to watch play out. But yeah, I definitely want to find someone to do that mixer. So if anybody's listening and you're a developer and you could potentially help code up for that mixer, reach out to us and yeah, we can find some funds through Moloch.
2 to 4 week projects, you'll be well funded. You'll be a hero. Everyone will know you.
Yeah, exactly. You'll be famous forever. I just want to get your take quickly on quote unquote Ethereum killers. I guess the three right now I would say specifically would be Cosmos, Polkadot, and Tezos. Polkadot, of course, isn't launched, but kind of gets the most notoriety just because, you know, it's got former Ethereum people tied to it and all that stuff. Do you see any legit threats there? Are you worried at all about Ethereum kind of losing its space as the go-to smart contract platform? And kind of why or why not?
Not really. I expect them to I would see like Ethereum in the middle and then like Cosmos, Tezos, Polkadot, Dfinity, what have you. They're sort of surrounding Ethereum. And I expect like some of the value to leak, you know, while Ethereum doesn't have sharding, while it doesn't have, easy to plug and play layer twos. But I also expect Ethereum to like figure it out. Ethereum is essentially a community of pragmatists. And so if we see something working, like we'll adopt it. And the people who, one, are building Ethereum, and two, who use it, are doing so because it's easier to program on. And, you know, you can estimate the cost of developing for a platform and like how much time it would take a programmer or a team of programmers to do the same thing on each platform. And I don't expect that to be much lower on these other competing chains. Potentially where they might have some advantages if they use their like very large war chests to fund things primarily to go to their platforms, right? Polkadot starts using a bunch of money or giving out a bunch of dots to people to use, then like I could see them, you know, getting some traction that way. But I think that's like mercenary traction. That's not really like fanatical loyalty traction. And Ethereum has like, you know, also interestingly, this like very broad grassroots community of fanatics who want to like, who earnestly want to build open, you know, tools to drive open finance, to onboard the rest of the world. And that's also something that's very difficult to replace. Vitalik like publishes the Plasma paper, and then you see this huge wave of open source research around it. And that's not something money can buy very easily, right? You see something like Uniswap show up, and Uniswap has $100 million of volume traded in less than a year of its inception. It was made essentially by, like, the contracts were written by one guy. You know, Kyokan helped with the front end, super small amount of effort when it's building it. And now it's like become the sort of building block that a lot of other projects can use. It plays into the sort of smart contract interoperability, the money Legos thesis, and further that, like, the advantage that Ethereum has as a first mover is, like, you might be able to fork the state. Like, you might be able to copy smart contracts. You can copy Uniswap, but, like, you'd have to convince a bunch of people to, like, move their tokens to your chain and then offer liquidity there. And so you can't fork liquidity very easily, right? I see Ethereum as, you know, Bitcoin has this, like, mimetic defense of, you know, it's store of value, it's gold, it's whatever. But, like, what Ethereum has is, you know, it's an open settlement layer for anything of value, right? And I don't see the proposition for it being this sort of core settlement layer being challenged very easily by any of the other upstart smart contract platforms, especially because they all sort of have to compete against each other. So it's like, you know, it's like this Mexican standoff where, like, Ethereum's in the middle and there's three guys around it, but the three guys are all, like, pointing guns at each other, and then they all, you know, shoot each other out. Ethereum's fine.
they seem to all be doing that with their communication, social strategy. So, I think that's definitely playing out so far.
Like, why, for example, would, like, MakerDAO move, right? That would be, like, big news. If MakerDAO, for example, decided that they wanted to move. But part of the reason that they won't is, like, the tools, you know, after having so much development gone through Ethereum, like, there's all these tools for it. It's really easy. It's much easier to build on it. You know, people underestimate, like, Stack Overflow network effects. Like, if I'm a programmer, like, one of the things that takes a long time is, like, am I the first one to hit this bug? Because, you know, if so, I'm going to have to figure it out. If not, like, I just Google it and Stack Overflow has my answer. And that's great. I think that's, like, pretty underestimated as well. Not to mention just, like, Ethereum is actually the only, like, incredibly decentralized smart contract platform. And once it moves to proof of stake, it'll be potentially even more decentralized. The point is to sort of be ungovernable. Like, I actually like the fact that Ethereum is, both perceived as and, like, very difficult to govern. And the reason why is because if, for example, something like SphinxChain were to be operating on Polkadot, for example, well, Polkadot is, you know, they're governable as hell. They're throwing their governance around like it's the sweetest thing ever. Same with, you know, Tezos and Cosmos. And what it means is, like, the participants who own those tokens can make sort of arbitrary changes to those platforms. And somebody like Polkadot could potentially even evict a parachain. And so it ends up being basically a permission platform that's governed by the token holders, which is, you know, Gavin and Ryan Zur and all their friends. And like adult businesses tend to be on the other side of consensus, right? That's why we're having all these issues with banks. That's, you know, the existing financial system tends to oppress. And, like, I could very easily see a future where SphinxChain is operating parachain on Polkadot on behalf of the adult industry. And then Polkadot says, hey, sorry, like, we're kicking you guys out because all these banking partners that we have, they bought a bunch of dots. They don't want you guys here. Right. And that would suck. Now, in order to, like, kick us out of Ethereum, you would have to get literally everyone who operates a full node to hard fork and upgrade to the code that, like, you know, erased our money or, like, froze our smart contract or something at the same time. And that's a lot harder to do. And so I feel much more secure building on SphinxChain because Ethereum, or building SphinxChain on Ethereum because Ethereum is credibly decentralized.
Yeah, fully agree. I've been calling all these other chains VC chains because most of the tokens are owned by a few VC funds. And I'm not a fan of on-chain governance whatsoever. In my opinion, it's a Trojan horse sitting in all of these competitors that's going to come back to bite them. And I much appreciate Ethereum. I think people are scared of Ethereum's governance because they're not sure It doesn't have a name. They're not sure what to call it. It's even tough to define, but I fully agree with you. I think that's a good thing in the long run. I mean, sure, maybe we can't have like clear 100% consensus on certain items, but you know, I still think the right things are going to get through, and we should be it shouldn't be easy to get large proposals through, right? And even if you have on-chain governance, let's say a vote's 55% to 45% on the network, those 45%, just because you have on-chain governance doesn't going to mean, you know, a fork's not going to happen. Those 45% can still go off and, you know, have fork and build their own chain. So just because you have on-chain governance doesn't mean you're really solving much.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the experiments are like, you know, they're touting on-chain governance, but they haven't like tested it yet.
Right. Yeah. Like, talk about capture.
You know, it makes a lot more sense to just wait. And like, you know, maybe it'll turn out that like on-chain governance is great with some caveats, or like maybe for specific things, right? Maybe it's like good for fund allocation, not good for like protocol upgrade decisions. And then we can decide to implement that, knowing what we know later. I'm excited for governance to be like a part of the blockchain narrative. I think it most applies to like layer two systems, right? Like, and so I guess I would prefer my layer one to be sort of ungovernable and secure. You know, this is the foundation. It's not going to shift out from under you. But then maybe the community that we engage around SpankChain, like it can decide on SpankChain things. And like if we have our own chain, you know, that we're managing, like it can decide on validation rules or something for that chain, but ultimately is secured by Ethereum in some way, you know, in a way that, you know, we're not worried about like the money being seized or censored in the way that we might be if we were issuing assets and leveraging, you know, at like Cosmos or Polkadot or Tezos or something as the like primary layer one platform.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we should have done a multi-part series because I think you and I could probably talk about Ethereum topics for days.
That's all we do.
Yeah, sure. That's all we've done with our life's last 5 years. literally sitting here talking about it. So
you could be in my living room. We'd be doing the same thing right now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. When I come over, since we're both close to each other, we'll just set down a mic and I'll put it out as part two.
Yeah, we'll do this on the beach.
Yeah, for sure. Summer's coming. All right. Well, Amin, thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it. I think it's been a great conversation. Kind of where's the best place for people to follow you or SpankChain or Moloch, or I guess what's the best place just for people to stay in contact with you?
Mostly on Twitter. So I'm Amin Sol on Twitter. We have an account for SpankChain too. It's just at SpankChain, and then Moloch DAO is at Moloch DAO. SpankChain also has a growing, vibrant Discord community. So check us out on Discord. The link is on our Twitter profile. So find us there.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining me.
Cool. Thanks for having me, Eric.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast.